Where am I? And how do I get home? These are questions that, though they sound a little like an alcoholic's remorse, human beings have been asking themselves for millennia, probably since even before our ancestors had developed language. Finding our way is an amazing feat of the human brain, and one our brains have developed specifically to perform. But it's also a task that, like so many others, most of us can now easily outsource to a GPS or a sat-nav. What does delegating the job of wayfinding to our smartphones and other devices do to our brains? Are we degrading one of the key abilities of human development? Well, that question and many others have been addressed in a new book, Wayfinding, The Art and Science of How We Find and Lose Our Way. And the author, Michael Bond, has found his way to a discussion with us on Sunday Extra. Michael, thanks very much for joining us on the program today.
You're welcome. Good to be with you.
Michael, you begin your book by saying that we as humans are explorers to the bone and that our spatial abilities are fundamental to what makes us human. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, I'm really talking about our evolutionary history. If you go back, say, 350,000 to 150,000 years ago, when Homo sapiens was evolving into modern humans, we were existing in small family groups mainly, and even at that age were extremely sociable. So these family groups would move around the landscape a lot and visit other neighboring groups. And there's evidence that they traveled 150 miles or more to trade and share food and swap stories with other groups. And they would have been traveling across a very primitive landscape where there weren't many humans around. And so they would have had to develop some fairly sophisticated navigation skills. So that's what I mean by these skills being fundamental to being human, is that we've had them all that time. And for a very long time, they were essential to our survival.
What actually happens when we get lost?
Well, that's a great question. Anyone who has been truly lost will never forget the experience, because it's quite terrifying. It's effectively a cognitive breakdown, really. We lose the ability to think properly, to rationalize, to make decisions. We often are convinced that we're going to die in that situation. And hence our behavior tends not to help us very much. We're always told if you go into the wilderness and you get lost that what you should really do is stop, hunker down and wait to be rescued. But most people just can't do that. They keep on moving, keep on running, walking, and invariably get themselves more lost. So it's like a big panic attack that we suffer. And in fact, in that moment, that reflects what our ancient ancestors would also have felt, because it seems as if that reaction is a survival instinct in some ways, because being lost in that primitive landscape would have meant certain death by being eaten by some carnivorous animal. And so they would have had to got out of that situation.
Of course, one of the aspects of that sort of terrifying scenario you just described of being lost in the woods or the like is that you don't have any anchor points. There's no sort of way of discerning a logic in this unfamiliar place. What did your research discover about the way early humans counteracted that and maybe even built it into our language?
For early humans, it would have been essential to be able to navigate, but also to remember places. And one of the things that historians have discovered is that early humans used to name places. Anywhere that they became familiar with was given a name. And this was a way of orientating them in the environment, because if you want to remember a place, it makes it easier if you can name it, particularly if the name includes some kind of description of the place. So the name could include animals that are found there or some features of the landscape, so that when you come upon this place, there are clues in the names as to where you are. A lot of those place names have stayed with us. Certainly where I am in the UK, some of the old place names are very descriptive. And I imagine also in Australia.
Yes, well, like I think if you take the name of our capital city, Canberra, it's supposedly derived from the local Ngunnawal language for meeting place. I don't know whether that would fit into the description that you're giving, but it does sound like, place names that very much give you navigational information as well.
Yeah, because as well as these names containing features of descriptions of a landscape, they could also have cultural references. So a place where people meet would be part of what anthropologists call a memoryscape, which is really a memory of places, including their cultural significance.
On Sunday Extra, we're speaking with Michael Bond, author of Wayfinding, the Art and Science of How We Find and Lose Our Way. Michael, what's different about the ways that kids roam about compared to adults?
A good example of this is if you ask an adult to navigate from A to B, usually they'll go straight there or find the most direct route. But if you ask a child to do that, they'll never go straight there. They will meander, they'll get distracted along the way, they'll find something interesting and stop and dawdle over it, and often they'll forget about the destination. This is because I think children are great explorers, really. They're explorers by instinct. And if they're in a new place, what they'll want to do is just find out about it. And so the routes that they take through an unfamiliar environment will be very different to the routes that an adult takes.
And you actually write in the book about how research into the way kids roam has literally saved lives. How is that?
So children, because they often don't go that far, researchers have been able to study their movements through the landscape. They've discovered, for example, that they tend to head towards places that look interesting or some kind of shelter or an odd feature in the landscape. So search and rescue experts, when they're looking for children, will tap into this information, and it definitely has saved children's lives.
You write at some length about the sort of emerging science of spatial cognition, and you say there's no doubt that cognitive maps underpin many of our most important functions. Can you sort of give us a bit of an outline of what is certain in the field of spatial cognition, and also maybe, you know, what there are some doubts about in this area?
So there's an area of the brain called the hippocampus, which is where most of our spatial cognition happens. And in the hippocampus, there are a group of cells that basically record where you are, that respond particularly to places that you're in. So if you go into a room, for example, that you haven't been in before, your place cells, as they're called, will fire up and respond in a particular configuration that's specific to that place, to that room. So that if you were then to go out of the room and, say, the next day come back into it, that network of place cells would fire up again in exactly the same way. And that basically is giving us a spatial memory. And also in this hippocampal area, there are other cells that tell us about distance and what direction we're facing, for example. And when we get to a border, a wall or an edge, then there's a different set of cells. So that part of our brain is really our spatial brain, allows us to navigate. But it also plays a role in other cognitive functions, such as other parts of memory, autobiographical memory, memory of events, uses all these spatial cells when we're imagining the future or making decisions about certain things. And particularly when we're thinking about our friends and our social networks, our brain uses a kind of map in the same way. So the cognitive maps that are formed in this part of the brain are useful not just for navigating, wayfinding, but also in other cognitive functions, which is why they're so important.
Now, you've also looked at what lessons can be learned from people who haven't had the chance to find their way much at all, who've experienced extreme isolation. What sort of scenarios were studied, and what were the lessons from extreme isolation?
Yes, so this obviously resonates with the experience a lot of people are going
through right now. It's on our minds all at the moment, absolutely.
But this research was rather more extreme. This was looking at prisoners in solitary confinement or kidnap victims who are confined in a very small space and also confined, isolated socially. Very quickly in those situations, people suffer a kind of cognitive breakdown, rather like being lost, ironically, the other end of the scale. In a small space, our brains just don't respond in the same way. And we find it difficult to perceive things accurately. We find it difficult to make decisions, and we become very paranoid and panic. Many of our functions are built on a spatial mechanism, as we just discussed. And when the space we're in is highly restricted, those functions seem to collapse in some ways. But there are ways to tackle this, because some kidnap victims and prisoners in solitary have managed to come through that experience with their sanity intact, if you like, by effectively wayfinding in their minds. They will use their imagination to make journeys in places that they're familiar with, or they will dream up mathematical problems, for example, that they'll then solve. And so they've managed to keep that part of their brain active, and it actually has helped them to remain mentally stable. Hopefully, right now, no one is in quite such an extreme situation at solitary, but those kind of tricks of the mind can definitely help us, I think.
Michael, I often think that I would be lost without my phone, and we all use our phones to get around these days. But you sound like a bit of a smartphone and GPS skeptic. Like, are you sort of waging a one-man war against the self-contained sat-nav in all our phones? What are your concerns?
Actually, I hoped I hadn't come across quite that way.
No.
Because my only point really is that it's been showed in studies that when we use these devices to navigate, and we, you know, we're solely following that set of instructions or the blue dot on the map, it circumvents that part of the brain that we use for navigating, that spatial part of the brain that's also used in many other cognitive functions. It's important, I think, just to be aware that that's what's happening, that we're not exercising that crucial part of the brain. The consequences of that are not clear. I mean, there are certainly some researchers who fear that if we don't use that essential part of the brain, the hippocampus, then we're storing up problems for ourselves. It's like anything, you know, we lose it if we don't use it. But we haven't really had them long enough, been using them long enough to know what the long-term effects of that might be. But I don't want to, you know, frighten anyone, but I think it's also important just to be aware that it does have an effect when we use them.
And of course, any of us who've ever travelled in a group of more than one have probably experienced the different levels of confidence about how individuals can find their way, which sometimes, but not always, correlates with how good they actually are at finding their way. I mean, are there just some people who are just inherently better at finding their way, and will they always be better? How trainable a skill is this?
Yeah, it's a great question. We do know quite a lot about this, in fact. I mean, partly it's to do with where you grew up. It seems that people who grew up in rural areas are better on average than people who grew up in cities, better at navigating. And this is thought to be because in rural areas, there are fewer straight lines. The environment around you is a bit more complex, and you have to use your brain basically to work out where you're going and where you are, and to understand your landscape. Whereas in a city, there are more straight lines and it's easier. It's actually also true that if you grew up in a very gritty city, so a place like New York, for example, where all the streets are parallel to each other or at right angles, then you end up not being as good as someone who grew up in a more complex city where the roads don't all go straight. So that reflects on, you know, how we use our brain, our spatial brain, when we're growing up. But also it has to do with the kind of childhood you had. As we talked about children who grow up being able to roam free to a certain extent, to use, you know, under their own steam to navigate and explore, they inevitably end up learning more about the space around them, and also becoming confident about moving around in unfamiliar places than those who are more restricted and who aren't allowed to leave their homes. I mean, it's very difficult growing up in a city now to have that freedom, of course. But these things all have an effect as you're growing up.
Well, it's been absolutely fascinating discussing the ins and outs of wayfinding with you. Michael Bond, thank you so much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
Thank you very much. It's been great being with you.
Michael is the author of Wayfinding, The Art and Science of How We Find and Lose Our Way.